Okay, we're going to open up. This is an exciting day because after 2 years, we're ready to go to Romans 3. We're just leaping ahead in bounds and strides. So we're going to go over to Romans 3. And the first thing I want to talk about, though, is something that I brought up over the last couple of weeks that I would really like to get us thinking about, is we have a tendency to view what God's doing today and its benefits to man, benefits to ourselves. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's glorious. Everything he's done for us, all those provisions of salvation, all that is glorious, infinitely glorious. But there's something that sometimes we ignore or don't think of at the same time when we're thinking about that, and that is the fact that the ultimate purpose of everything God does is for his glory. His glory is the key thing that's involved here. You know, when I've had some times in life when very bad times in life, and I can remember talking to another grace pastor, and he said, I was complaining to him. I said, God never answers my prayer. I keep praying for this, and nothing changes. This situation just keeps going on and on and on, and nothing changes. And you know what he said to me? And it changed my life. He said, well, maybe you need to stop spending so much of your prayer time telling God what he ought to do and listen to what God wants you to do. And, you know, just that simple thing of coming to the realization that God is the center of everything and not us, that just opened the way. And that situation I was cowering, avoiding, fearful of, I just at that moment stood up and entered into it, and a lot of good things ended up coming out of it. And I guess, I don't know if I'm explaining it well or not, but while we need to appreciate our provision of salvation, God's made those blessings available to us, all those blessings of the cross, all the things that come to us through the person and work of his Son, they're all glorious, they come out of the glory of God, but what I think sometimes we don't think about is what God gets out of the person and work of Christ. What there's something that God, that is said about God in that cross work of Christ, beyond what's meant for us, what the meaning is for us, there's also a meaning for God. And that prayer was a thing. Just think how your life would be revolutionized if instead of going to prayer and talking to God about what you want, what if you went to prayer and talked to God about what he wants? What if in your worship, the whole world is out claiming to be worship, or not the whole world, a part of the world is out claiming to be worshiping God the way they want to worship God? Well, what if you worship God the way he wants you to worship him? What if in your service, you know, we're told these days, find your talent, find the thing you like to do, and do that for God. Well, I'm glad Paul didn't listen to that advice, because Paul says he went out and preached, and he wasn't even a good preacher. He wasn't one of his talents. And as a matter of fact, you get a lot of his writings, he didn't even like it that much. And yet he went out because that's what God told him to do. What if we did our service not based on what we like or what we think our natural talents are, but on what God wants us to do? And I'm just trying to bring this out that there's sometimes we're born man-centered, right? Has anyone here who's had children ever had to teach their baby to be baby-centered? Nobody, right? They're just born baby-centered. We're all born man-centered. Everything revolves around us. And a pitfall we can fall into, especially as we're led by historic Christianity, who has rejected Paul's distinctive apostleship. They've apostatized from God's truth from today. And as we follow them, because, you know, grace teachers can't come up with everything every week, right? There aren't many commentators and many teachers that with the mid-Acts position. So what do? When we want to try and get a leg up on the horse for a study or a teaching, we sometimes have to read people who don't rightly divide, some people who don't distinguish Paul's apostleship. And the important thing for us to remember is that everything centers around God. Those other theologies are man-centered. They're centered on what God's doing for man. And let me make it clear, I'm not minimizing what God's done for man. It's glorious, it's infinitely glorious, it's wondrous. But there's also something that comes, I think, before that, and what it means for God. And why do I bring this up as we're going into Romans 3. I think this is very important for Romans 3 because usually we just think of this teaching of the justification by grace through faith in terms of what we get out of it. And that's glorious. I'm not diminishing that one bit. But what I'm going to suggest as we go into Romans 3 now, we also not only think of what it means for us, but what it means for God. And what if we ask first, not what does justification do for us, but what does justification mean for us, but what does justification by grace through faith mean for God? And that's one of the main things I think Paul's driving home in Romans 3. He's going to show us how God can maintain his righteousness while at the same time declaring wrong sinners right. And that is a pinnacle of importance. How God can maintain his glory, maintain his righteousness, maintain his holiness, and at the same time declare wrong sinners, unrighteous people, right. Now, he could do what most of the world thinks. Most of the world, you ask your friends, right? And what do they think? They think they're not that bad. You know, God's only going to keep out the ones in the jail. They'll manage to get in. They're not that bad. They have enough good works to get into heaven. God won't, you know, they'll be able to sneak in. Maybe they'll have to go in the back door instead of the front of heaven, but they'll get in. And if God could have said, I'm just going to let everyone into heaven, sinner or otherwise. But then you know what that would mean? That would mean God ceased to be righteous. God ceased to be holy. God ceased to be just. God would cease to be God. And Paul's going to come along here in Romans 3, and he's going to show us how God could declare wrong people right, and God maintains his holiness, righteousness, and righteousness, and holiness, and justness. And so that's what I really want to bring home here, is this gloriousness of God's provision. I think last week I said, all Romans isn't all about our salvation. It's all really about God's glory. And I say that not diminishing the glory of our provision of salvation and what God has done for us. I'm not wanting to diminish that. What I'm trying to do is raise up the glory of God, because we tend to look in our man-centered way at only what it means for us. But I'm driving home the point here that it also means something for God. He's found a way where he can maintain his righteousness and holiness and declare wrong sinners right with him. And so the gloriousness of God's provision for salvation not only means something for man, but it means something for God as well. And so I just wanted to bring that up, if there is any confusion or anything last week. I don't think I said it real well last week, but our provision of salvation is glorious. It's infinitely glorious. It comes out of the glory of God, but we don't want to miss that it also means something about God in that provision and his glory. And we want to see them both together. And that's going to be really important to keep that in mind as we enter into Romans 3. Now, one of the ways as we go into Romans 3, we can think about Romans 1 to 3. And one of the first ways when I was learning Romans, a teacher who was teaching Romans, said that Romans 1 to 3 is preparing the ground for laying the foundation of justification by grace through faith. And if we think of that teaching starting in Romans 3:21 as laying the foundation of justification by grace through faith, as we think of that as the foundation, they say to think of the first 2.5 chapters as kind of preparing the ground. You know, I've never built anything. I think the last time I built anything was with Lincoln Logs when I was 8 or 9. So I don't know what you do to build the foundation. So if I don't get this right, just let it go, because I don't have any idea how to build a house, never built a house. But the idea here is that you're going to lay this foundation and the ground has to be prepared. We know even Jesus said if you build a house on sand, it gets washed away in the first storm that comes along. And as we look at Romans, the first 2.5 chapters of Romans, if we think of it as preparing the ground, and of course the ground there is the human mind, the ground for receiving the foundation of justification by grace through faith that he's going to do in Romans 3:21. And we can think of that ground preparation. You have to make sure it's firm enough. You dig a hole and you get it ready. And so when the foundation's poured into it, it'll stay firm and be there for the long haul. Now, most people when they talk about the preparing of the ground, what do most people talk about when they talk about the preparing of the ground? What are they referring to? They usually call the first 2.5 chapters man's something like man's ruin and God's wrath. Man is utter. What the first thing man needs to know is they are utterly sinful and they're utterly ruined and they're utterly worthy of the wrath of God. They're come under God's condemnation. And what's the point of that teaching? That point of that teaching is that then when you get over to Romans 3:21, when he starts laying the foundation of justification by grace through faith, well, you'll recognize your need for that and you'll receive it in faith. And that's perfectly valid. I agree with that. I think that's a true thing as you work through your, it's preparing the ground by making sure fallen humanity recognizes their utter sinfulness and need for salvation, need for justification by grace through faith. So I'm in total agreement with that, that building metaphor and preparing the ground with that doctrine of man's ruin and God's wrath. But where I would add, not so much disagree, but add, is that most people, most teachers stop there, right? They think that's what the whole thing is about, is preparing us to receive that. But I'm going to suggest there's two teachings in first 2.5 chapters of Romans that are critically important. There are two teachings that are interwoven together, and both are required to perfectly and completely prepare the ground for reception of justification by grace through faith. One of those is what most people recognize, is that he's presenting before fallen humanity the utter fallenness and sinfulness and wrathworthiness of humanity. And he's in chapter 2, he's ruled out every excuse. He's knocked down every defense. And man, now when he comes into Romans 3, where Paul is talking about justification by grace through faith, he'll recognize his need and receive it by faith. And I'm in total agreement with that. But what I would suggest is that people stop there who don't rightly divide. If you've thrown away Paul's distinctive apostleship, if you throw that away, if you set it aside, if you willfully have rejected that, then you're not going to see the second teaching that goes into preparing the ground for justification by grace through faith, and that's Paul's distinctive apostleship. Remember, when Romans opens up, it doesn't open up in those first verses by talking about our utter sinfulness. He picks up on that starting in Romans 1:18 and following. That book opens up with God declaring to the universe that he's raised up this new and unique apostle, separated him from all others, drawn him into a sphere of activity in his good news, and he's raised up this new and unique apostle, given him, the risen Lord has given him a new and unique apostleship, a new and unique message of grace, and a new and unique program whereby God can bless the world, especially the Gentiles, apart from Israel and through her fall. That's the first teaching in Romans. And to throw that away or minimize it is to call into question the glory of God. Because just turn back to verse 5 of chapter 1. And let's see what's at stake in Paul's distinctive apostleship. Verse 5 of chapter 1. By whom we have received grace and apostleship. That's Paul. He's raised up Paul, given him this new and unique apostleship for obedience to the faith among all nations for his name. The very first reason God gives for creating, I guess would be a good word, creating Paul's distinctive apostleship is for his name. And name, you know, in the biblical sense, name is everything that's true about somebody. He has created this new apostleship and raised up this distinct apostle Paul for the glory of his name, for his name's sake, for his name. That's the very first thing we learn in Romans before we get to man's utter sinfulness. Both are important, and I'm not minimizing one. I'm just saying that when we read other commentators who have thrown away Paul's apostleship and rejected the distinctiveness of his apostleship, then they don't see this. They call it an introduction, a salutation, a greeting, a, a, you know, Paul just fulfilling the letter writing obligations of his days, that kind of thing. But what's really going on here is God announcing to the world, he's raised up this new and unique apostleship, distinct apostleship, and he's doing it for his glory. He's invested Paul's apostleship with his own glory. And I'm suggesting that in addition to the teaching in the first 2.5 chapters about man's ruin and wrathworthiness, in addition to that, there's a second line of teaching that's interwoven with that, that is the distinctiveness of Paul's apostleship. Recognizing it's not to fully prepare the ground to receive the foundation of justification by grace through faith requires recognizing our need for it and our ruin and our wrathworthiness before God. And it also, to have that ground completely prepared, requires that we just as equally and strongly recognize and appreciate Paul's distinctive apostleship. Paul's distinctive apostleship. So, number 6, what according to God and Paul, in order to fully prepare the ground for the laying of the foundational doctrine of justification by grace through faith, we must work in both the recognition of our sinfulness and ruin, along with the recognition of Paul's distinctive apostleship. And that's what most people miss. That's what we need to bring out, and I think it'll become pretty clear why that's a necessity. As we go through this, to reject Paul's distinct apostleship, as historical Christianity has done since the days of Paul himself. Remember, we've looked at this in the past. What were Paul's sobering words to Timothy? All in Asia have turned away from me. They were turning. What was the problem in Galatia? They were turning away from Paul. What was the problem in Corinth? They were turning away from Paul. What was the problem with the Thessalonians? They were starting to turn away from Paul. They were turning away from Paul in his very days he was there. To reject Paul's distinct apostleship is to inadequately prepare the ground for the foundation of justification by grace through faith. And that was started in Paul's very day. And you know, there's from when Paul goes off the scene, there's about 40 years silence. There's nothing, you know, no church fathers or anything really going on during the time. And then all of a sudden you get those first church fathers, and they've already lost the teaching of justification by grace through faith. They're already teaching justification on the basis of water baptism, especially infant baptism and things like that. And that's, see, once you throw away Paul's distinct apostleship, the ground isn't going to be perfectly prepared for the reception of just the foundation of justification by grace through faith. Now, why? Why is that the case? Why? Because Paul, if we kind of take that building metaphor again, if we think of recognizing and appreciating that man has fallen and wrathworthy and utterly sinful and has no excuse to escape God's judgment, and all his defenses have been knocked down, and we kind of think of that as digging the hole for that foundation to be laid in, and kind of solidifying the sides and digging the hole and whatever else you do to prepare the ground in that way, Paul's apostleship is the water-impervious liner that goes around that foundation so that there's no water seepage. What happens, even I know this, what happens when water seeps into your foundation over time? It starts to degrade it, right? It starts to, your foundation maybe sinks or settles, or maybe you get a crack. And Paul's apostleship is that wrap that goes around the foundation that prevents, I guess we continue the metaphor, the water of error from creeping in and unsettling that foundation. Unsettling it. And to minimize or discard Paul's distinct apostleship brings confusion into God's, what God is doing today. It unsettles the situation. It makes you question. If you are saved by grace through faith, but now you've thrown away Paul's distinctive apostleship, you're instantly saved and eternally secure. I'm not calling into question of that, but I am saying if you're being taught that the church began at Pentecost under Peter and the 12, well then it seems to me like the only thing you would do is trying to reinvent the Church of Pentecost under Peter and the 12. You'd try to reinvent those Pentecostal gifts, and that's how you'd spend your Christian life, trying to do things that God isn't doing today. Or if you think the church started in the gospel, well, then you're going to go to the gospels and you're going to try and do things that Jesus told his disciples to do in the gospels. You're going to be involved in things that God's not doing today. You're going to be bringing confusion, just like the Galatians did, just like the Corinthians did, and a little bit of what those Thessalonians did as they were leaving, especially with end time teaching of Paul, as they were leaving that. And so Paul's distinct apostleship is what keeps error out. If you think your church began at Pentecost under Peter and the 12, then you're going to go to that for your mold. If you think it began in the Gospels, you're going to go to that for your mold. If you believe what historic Christianity says, you're just spiritual Israel, well, then why wouldn't you go back to the law? Obviously, you go back to the law. You're spiritual Israel. God gave the law to Israel, so of course you're going to go back to the law. And you just bring confusion into your Christian life and your experience, and the ground hasn't been perfectly prepared for that justification by grace through faith. That ground needs to have the water impermeable barrier of Paul's apostleship. Because you know, the minute you receive the distinctive Paul's apostleship, you realize all those other things disappear. Because if the church began with Paul in mid-Acts, then it didn't begin at Pentecost, it didn't begin in the Gospels, and you're not spiritual Israel. And poof, all the error disappears. And you're on the solid foundation then, the solid ground that you've prepared is solid. So as we go into Romans 3, this is going to become critically important, and we've seen the interweaving of these two truths. I agree with most conservative Bible teachers anyway, that he's presenting man's ruin and God's wrath here, and man's wrath-worthiness. But what most Bible teachers miss is he's always presenting here the distinctive apostleship of Paul and the glory God has invested in that. That's what God, the instrument God is using today to dispense the riches of his goodness, as we see in Romans 2. The riches of his goodness and forbearance and long-suffering, and we go to Romans 11 and on to Ephesians. It's the riches of his salvation to the world, especially the Gentiles, the riches of his glory, the riches of his mercy, the riches of his grace, and it just goes on and on and on. And that is just as important as man's ruin and God's wrath to have the ground perfectly prepared for the reception of what most people say he's giving in Romans 3, last half of Romans 3, a justification by grace through faith. You need both of those teachings to have the ground perfectly prepared. If the foundation is just laid based on your understanding of your sin, and that's great, your understanding of sin, instantly saved, eternally secure, all that, but the ground is not going to be perfectly prepared. Error is going to come in, and during your experience, during life here, you're going to be thrown off course. You're going to be confused. You're going to be trying to get God to do things he's not doing. You're going to be often doing things that he's not doing today, and it's going to end up of no eternal value, that life, those experience you're doing here, because the adversary will have thrown you off track. And rather than recognizing what God's doing today through the apostleship of Paul. That's what we saw in Corinth. That's what you see in Corinth. That's what you see in Galatia. That's what you see in Thessalonica. The only ground that is firm, secure, and stable enough to hold the foundation of justification by grace through faith is the ground prepared, yes, with man's ruin and wrathworthy, and the distinctive apostleship of Paul. That's the only thing that's going to keep out the waters of error. As soon as you throw away the distinctive of Paul's apostleship, you have historic Christianity. Thousands of sects, hundreds of denominations, tens of so-called Christian religions, a church on every street corner, all saying something different, all very far away from what Paul says is God's purpose in Romans 15, where he says what God wants us to be doing is all believers together speaking with one mind, or praising him with one mind and one mouth. And what a far cry that is. And the only thing that will bring believers together and praise God with one mind and one mouth is to embrace the distinctiveness of Paul's apostleship. Because as soon as you do that, it's like a man or a person going through the desert. They're hot. And what do they see? They see water ahead. And they're racing to it, burning up more energy and more energy. And they get to it, and it's a mirage. It's not really there. It doesn't exist. And that's what, whenever you leave Paul's distinctive apostleship with what God is accomplishing through that, you're off chasing something that's not there. It's a mirage. It's a man-made thought. It's a man-made plan, and it's not a part of what God's doing today. And so you need both of those things. You need the wrath-worthiness of man and this utter sinfulness of man and their need for justification by grace through faith. And you also need to recognize and appreciate the distinctiveness of Paul's ministry, because that's the only thing that's going to preclude the waters of error getting in and around that foundation and altering and throwing you off course in your Christian life. All right, so why do we bring this up? As we get into Romans 3, let's go ahead and flip over there and let's read. Let's enter into Romans 3 and get it introduced. I'm going to go through this a lot more carefully over the next few weeks, but for now, I just want to bring out the overall flow of the passage. Let's look at verse 1. Let's just read through the first 7 or 8 verses, and we can kind of get the flow of it here. What advantage then hath the Jew, or what profit is there of circumcision? Remember, we just ended Romans 2, and Paul has argued that just having the law, or even teaching the law, isn't the issue. The issue is doing the law. And he shows that they're lawbreakers. They've broken the law. They've blasphemed God's name and breaking the law. And then he looks at their circumcision, and they think that having external circumcision puts them in a privileged position before God. And Paul says, no, it's not. God's going to judge the secrets of men, the hidden things of men, and he's not going to look at the external circumcision. He's going to look to see if the heart is circumcised. And so he says the key things aren't outer circumcision, and the key thing isn't having the law or even teaching the law. It's doing, and they've already failed that. And in breaking the law, they've also made their external circumcision uncircumcision. They've been brought to the same level as the Gentile. They've been brought to the same level. So what's obviously is a Jewish person going to say? Well, Paul, verse 1 of chapter 3, what advantage then is there to being a Jew? Or what profit is there of circumcision? Much, every way, chiefly because that unto them were committed the oracles of God. So here he's drawing out the important thing to remember in this section is he's still talking about the Jews and Israel. He's answering questions about the Jews and Israel. And the most important thing for them were these oracles of God, the word and worship system of God. Verse 3. For what if some did not believe? Shall their unbelief make the faith of God without effect? God forbid. Yea, let God be true and every man a liar, as it is written, that thou mightest be justified in thy sayings and mightest overcome when thou art judged. But if our unrighteousness commend the righteousness of God, what shall we say? Is God unrighteous, who takes vengeance? I speak as a man. God forbid, for then how shall God judge the world? For if the truth of God hath more abounded through my lie unto his glory, why yet am I judged as a sinner? And not rather, as we be slanderously reported, and as some affirm that we say, that we do that let us do evil, that good may come, whose damnation is just. And so now let's take a look at this. Let's get the general idea here of what this is about. I don't want to scare anyone away, but I have a very scholarly commentator who writes about this and says, this is the most difficult passage in all Paul's writings. And it is a little convoluted, but is it really the most difficult thing? And he quotes other commentators throughout history who say the same thing. So why do some commentators find this the most difficult passage in Paul's writings? And that's something we're going to kind of want to take a look at as we go through here. Usually, the way this section is presented is, you know, God and Paul have already removed all the excuses in chapter 2. And now they're knocking down any last-minute defenses by people. They're trying to throw up these defenses, and they acknowledge their ridiculous defenses. They usually say things like, this is just comes out of the foolishness of man's thinking. Man's reasoning is so bad, only they would say something like this. Because what it sounds like they're saying is that if my unrighteousness, my lie, my sin, we could just say that, my unrighteousness is an opportunity for God to display his righteousness in punishing us or anything else, then why would I still be considered a sinner? Why would I still be considered worthy of God's wrath? And the idea there is that they're arguing this foolish concept. They're actually trying to switch the blame from themselves and blame God. And they're saying that if my unrighteousness puts on display God's righteousness, well, then he's used it for good, and I ought not to be punished then. I should be appraised for doing something good. And as we come into here, we can see that it's just a ridiculous thing. And many commentators say it's so difficult? And I found one. I went through about 15, 20 of my commentaries to look at it, see how they handled this passage. And one put it this way, and I thought it was pretty good, is it just doesn't have the ring of truth. And I'd probably change the word truth to reality. It doesn't have the ring of reality. You know, in chapter 2, I run into people all the time who are minimizing and relativizing away their sin. They're using that relative human righteousness. But you know, I don't think I've ever run into anyone with the argument of chapter 3, where yes, we're basically acknowledging I'm an utter sinful person, and because of that, God should let me off the hook. I've never heard anyone really say that, almost bragging and boasting, because the more sinful I am, the more God's glory shows in his righteousness. And that's what that commentator means. It just doesn't have the ringer. He's never heard anyone use that argument. And I went through 15, maybe 20 commentaries to see if anyone could give an example of it. And the only example I got out of all those commentaries was when they referred to universalists, who believe that God is going to eventually save everybody. But then in the next sentence, you know what he said? He said, but the universalists really don't say this either. So we're left with this problem here. And what is going on in this passage? Why do at least some commentators find it so difficult? Why does it seem, I mean, maybe somebody here has experienced this, but I've never talked to anyone who was boasting about their utter sinfulness and being a liar and unfaithful and all that and thought that was a reason God should let them off the hook. Everyone I talked to said, yeah, I may sin, but it's not that bad. I'd still be good enough for God, that kind of thing. And so let's just think of what if there might be another explanation to this passage, keeping in mind that there's two lines of truth in Romans 1-3, which we just talked about. One that is the only one most commentators see as the ruin and wrathworthiness of man, so they try to apply this passage to that. But remember, for those who rightly divide, there's a second line of truth woven in with that, and that's the distinctive apostleship of Paul. And what I'd suggest is this passage is dealing primarily with responses to the distinctive apostleship of Paul, rather than primarily. I'm not saying the ruin of man isn't in here. I'm just saying if we look at this, this is an attack on Paul's distinctive apostleship. And we take it and look at it at like that. Remember, as we go through here, that remember how Romans 1 opened. Romans 1 opened up by God declaring to the universe that he created Paul's distinct apostleship for the glory of his name. That's how Romans opens. Now, if you throw that away, you throw it away, but that is how Romans opens. Romans 2 opens up by saying the very way God's dispensing the riches of his glory is through that apostleship. And now in Romans 3, we're going to find that where Paul had been insisting that his distinctive apostleship is invested with the glory of God. It manifests the glory of God. It gloriously displays what God's doing today. Now he has his critics coming along and say, no, your distinctive apostleship destroys God's glory. It ruins God's glory. He's dealing with last-ditch attempts here. They may be last-ditch attempts, but they're not so much people trying to escape their ruin and wrathworthiness. They're people trying to escape Paul's apostleship. And they're trying to call into question his distinctive apostleship. And they're going to be saying, if what you're saying is true, Paul, if your apostleship is right, then you're not manifesting or invested with God's glory. You're ruining and destroying God's glory. And that's what we want to look at next. Romans 3 likewise has the emphasis on Paul's apostleship. And the first thing to remember, let's look at verses 1 and 2 again. What advantage then hath the Jew, and what profit is there of circumcision? Much every way, chiefly because that unto them were committed the oracles of God. Remember, keep this in your mind. Usually, I find this very interesting, as commentators start with those verses and talk about the Jews, but then in the next verse after this, they refer to all humanity. And I'd suggest that this whole section is dealing with Jews, is dealing with the issue of the Jews bringing up an issue about God and Israel and Paul's unique apostleship. In the light of Paul's distinct apostleship, is there a simple reason why Jews would accuse Paul of saying God is unfaithful, unrighteous, and untruthful? The point, the thrust of this passage is that you've got someone, whatever it means, someone is trying to lay the weight on God that they would be unfaithful, unrighteous, and untruthful for doing something. And what he's going to bring out here is, what is the simplest answer for why a Jew, because this is about Jews, he's asking the advantage of national Israel, why would a Jew, in light of national Israel, say Paul's apostleship, if it's true, makes God unfaithful, unrighteous, and untruthful? And the simple answer is, because if what Paul's saying is true, then God has broken his promises to Israel. Therefore, he's unfaithful. Paul, your apostleship isn't what you said in the first two chapters, invested with the glory of God and manifesting the glory of God. Your apostleship is calling into question the glory of God. Your apostleship is ruining the glory of God. And that's what we want to look at next, is how can a Jew say such a thing? And it's very easy, really, especially with a little selective hearing. What did Paul say? When he went, he was running around the world, and where did he go first? To the synagogues. And what was he there telling them? He was saying that God had cast away Israel. God had blinded Israel. God had cast away Israel. Israel had stumbled. Israel had fallen. Israel now was in unbelief and unrighteousness. God is dealing with her severely. And he goes on and lists things that, with selective hearing, you could say, Paul's saying God's all done with Israel. And if God's all done with Israel, like most of Christianity says as well, if God's all done with Israel, then what the Jewish adversaries are saying here would be right. He would be unfaithful, unrighteous, and untruthful, because he would have broken his promises to Israel. And so that's what we're going to look at next here is, he would have heard him say that Israel's been cast aside, Israel's stumbled and fallen, God is now treating her in severity because of her unbelief and unrighteousness, he's broken off her branches. That's what they would be picking out from what Paul said. And I got those, we're going to go there in a minute, those are all from Romans 11, by the way. But we'd hold off on going there yet, because we're going to prepare a little more. It is as though Paul's enemies are trying to prosecute Paul's apostleship by dragging God himself into the witness box to bear witness against Paul's teaching. It's as though they've set up a court, they're prosecuting Paul, and now, in a desperation to discredit Paul's apostleship, they try to drag God himself into the witness box. And they want God to bear witness against Paul. And they're standing there saying, if what you're saying, Paul, is correct, And God will verify this. If what you're saying is correct, then God is unfaithful. God is unrighteous. God is untruthful, because if what you're saying is true, then God has broken his promises to Israel. And they want, it's as though they've dragged God himself into the witness box and said to get him to bear witness against Paul. But needless to say, it's not going to work, right? Paul, God doesn't bear witness about Paul. And there's one simple word that will obliterate the whole prosecution strategy. Does anyone guess what that word is? We'll play Wheel of Fortune. I'm going to start writing it, and whoever can guess the word first, well, you just get a handshake or something. The reason why what they say are trying to get God to witness against Paul is wrong, when they say, you're telling me that God has blinded Israel, God has cast away Israel, Israel has stumbled, Israel has fallen, you're saying God's all done with Israel. But with selective hearing, because there's only one word God needs to say and obliterates the whole prosecution strategy. And that means temporary. Exactly. It's temporary. The setting aside of Israel is temporary. If it wasn't temporary, if it was permanent, then they would be right. God would be unfaithful. And that's unrighteous and untruthful, because he would have broken his promises to Israel. And they would have been right. But now we're going to go, let's go over to Romans 11 and see why they're misquoting Paul. All right, Romans 11. Let's just begin at verse 7. What then? Israel hath not obtained that which he seeketh for, but the election hath obtained it, and the rest were blinded. See, Paul, you're saying God blinded Israel. Look at verse 25, though. Skip down to verse 25. For I would not, brethren, that ye should be ignorant of this mystery, lest you should be wise in your own conceits, that blindness in part has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles come in. It's a partial blindness, not a complete blindness, not a forever blindness. Look down at let's just read down through verse 8. According as it is written, God hath given them up the spirit of slumber, eyes that they should not see, and ears that they should not hear unto this day. And David saith, let their table be made a snare and a trap and a stumbling block and a recompense unto them. Let their eyes be darkened that they may not see, and bow down their back always. And this situation, though, isn't going to go on. It's a partial blindness. It's only going to go on until, as he says in verse 25, that fullness of the Gentiles come in. Verse 11, I say then, have they stumbled that they should fall? Paul, you say they've stumbled and fallen. And Paul says they have stumbled and fallen, but it's not a permanent fall. It's not a permanent fall. Look at let's pick it up, verse 11 again. I say then, have they stumbled that they should fall? God forbid. But rather, through their fall, salvation has come unto the Gentiles for to provoke them to jealousy. Now, if the fall of them be the riches of the world, remember Romans 2:4? That's how Paul describes his apostleship, as the dispensing of God's riches. God's using the instrument of Paul's apostleship to dispense the riches, his riches, today. Now, if verse 12, now if the fall of them be the riches of the world and the diminishing of them the riches of the Gentiles, Paul, if you're saying they've fallen, they've stumbled, and that God's program with Israel, his prophetic program with Israel, is diminishing and about ready to fade out. But look at the last phrase in verse 12. How much more their fullness. See, it's just temporary. Right now they're diminishing, but they will be received in their fullness in the future. It's like today in technological terms. You know, you're watching the football game or a movie or something, and what do? You want to go and get some popcorn. So what do? You pause it. And today you can pause it right where it's at. You go up, take a phone call, make your popcorn, do whatever you do. You come back down, and what do? You unpause it, and you pick up right where you left off again. And that's what God's going to do with Israel's program. He's put it on pause. He hasn't totally shut down the whole electronic system. He's put it on pause. And now, in the future, he's going to just hit the pause button again and it just starts up again. God isn't unfaithful. He's not unrighteous. He's not untruthful. He's going to completely fulfill all his promises and word to Israel. Look at verse 14. Verse 13. For I speak to you Gentiles, insomuch as I am the apostle of the Gentiles, I magnify mine office, if by any means I may provoke to emulation them which are my flesh, and might save some of them. For if the casting away, see, Paul, you say God has cast away Israel. For if the casting away of them be the reconciling of the world, what shall the receiving of them be but life from the dead? Yes, he's cast them away, but one day he's going to restart his program with them, and he's going to be receiving them like it's life from the dead. Verse 16, for if the first fruits be holy, the lump is also holy, and if the root be holy, so are the branches. And we can continue to read on down through there, but their branches are going to be back in life too. And God isn't completely done with Israel. He's just put Israel and her program on hold, on pause. And now he's doing this work through Paul's apostleship among the Gentiles, and when that's primarily among the Gentiles, and when that's complete, he's just going to go hit the pause button and restart Israel's program and bring that to complete fulfillment, like life from the dead. And that's his answer to the prosecuting. They've dragged God himself. They've tried to drag God himself into the witness booth, and they're trying to make him bear witness against Paul, saying, boy, if what Paul's saying is true, if this apostleship is really true, then God's all done with Israel, and that would make God unfaithful, untruthful, and unrighteous. But the key thing there is it's only temporary. It's a partial blindness, a temporary putting on hold of their program. Let's flip a page to 33, and let's see something now. We see Paul's apostleship. They're attacking Paul's apostleship in the first 8 verses of Romans 3. If we understand it that way, it's Israel's Jewish attack on his apostleship, and they're trying to draw into question after he spent 2 chapters showing that his apostleship was invested with the glory of God and was the way God is dispensing his glory today. Now you have these Jewish critics who come along and say, no, if what Paul's saying is true, then God is unglorious. He has no glory because he's unfaithful to Israel and hasn't kept his promises to Israel. And Paul, what he brings up in Romans 3, he completely develops in Romans 9, 10, 11, and as we went through Romans 11 here. So when they get him in this court, God hasn't done what they want him to do. All God has to say is temporary. It's just a temporary. He's put it on pause. It's not a permanent setting aside of Israel. And the glory of God in the apostleship of Paul is maintained. Look at verse 33 of chapter 11. Look at, after he's gone through this, after he's explained Israel's blindness and casting away and stumbling and fall and him treating them severely and all that, and branches broken out and all that, and he says it's all temporary. God one day will come and completely fulfill all the promises he made to Israel. And he describes it as a mystery, something secret, something kept hidden since the world began. Until, let me just add on the end there, a secret kept secret since the world began until he revealed it to and through the Apostle Paul. Verse 33, listen to Paul's eulogy to God's glory in his apostleship. Remember, this chapter began, let's flip back a page because I think it would be important to read. Look at verse 13. For I speak to you Gentiles. This is chapter 11, verse 13. For I speak to you Gentiles, inasmuch as I am the apostle of the Gentiles, I magnify mine office. See, Paul magnified his office. He didn't magnify himself. He magnified what God was doing through him, what God had made his service to be, his ministry to be, his apostleship to be. And now, after showing what God is going to do with Israel, he's not completely cast them away. He's not permanently let them fall. He's not completely blinded them. It's only temporary and partial. He says in verse 33, oh, the depth of the riches of the wisdom and knowledge of God. how unsearchable. That's the mystery. You can't search it out. You can't look for it anyplace else. Not in the Old Testament, not in the Gospels, not in the writings of Peter and the 12. It's unsearchable are his judgments and his ways past finding out. Who had ever thought of this? Who hath known the mind of the Lord? And who hath been his counselor? Or who hath first given to him? And it shall be recompensed unto him. What human would have ever even thought of such a thing? Verse 36, for of him and through him and to him are all things, to whom be glory forever. The glory of God in the distinctive apostleship of Paul in explaining what God had kept secret since the world began, since before the world began. This was a secret hid, he tells us in Ephesians, hid in God. Not hidden in the scriptures, not mysteriously placed in the scriptures, but secretly hid away in God. And what he's doing today through that, and now calling unto himself a group of redeemed believers called the church, the body of Christ. And it's all for the glory of his name. Remember, don't start your theology like historical Christianity does with Genesis 3 with the fall of man. Started in Genesis 1:1 with the creation of the heaven and the earth. And then you can see that God immediately focuses on the earth and its fall. And he explains how he's going to reestablish his glory on earth through the nation Israel. But he never ever spoke before about how he's going to reestablish in the heavenlies, which have also fallen. Remember the satanic rebellion. How is he going to reestablish his glory in the heavenlies? And that was kept secret until it was revealed to and through the Apostle Paul, whereby he's now calling out a group of redeemed sinners who he's now gathered together in the body of Christ, and it will be through them that he's going to reestablish his glory in the heavenlies. Who would have ever thought such a thing? He writes to the Corinthians, and he explains that it was kept secret because if the world knew about it and the dark powers of darkness behind them, they wouldn't have crucified the Lord. It's something kept totally secret, not only from the world of men, but the heavens of angels, the spiritual realm of angels. And it goes all the way back, and it all hinges, not first of all, on redeeming sinners, and it does do that, and that's important and infinitely glorious. But it first of all is the way he's going to reestablish his own glory throughout the whole universe. And that's the two most fundamental things we need to know if our ground is going to be completely and perfectly prepared for the reception of justification by grace through faith. Because not only do we receive justification by grace through faith, recognizing our own sinfulness and wrathworthiness, that's very important, that's extremely important, that's what we all need to do. But in addition to that, when we recognize and appreciate Paul's distinctive apostleship, when we weather barrier that foundation with Paul's distinctive apostleship, then that keeps out the water seepage of error. And that can creep in around that foundation and throw us off course once we've been saved by grace through faith, bring in confusion and error and other issues. And that's what I think he's talking about. We're going to go through the first 8 verses in Romans 3:1-8 a lot more carefully, but I just wanted to bring that out. And he's talking about Jews now who are attacking his apostleship. They're attacking one of the ways we prepare the ground for the reception of Paul's further truth here. They're trying to keep the ground ill-prepared by having us throw away, like most of Christianity has done, the distinctive apostleship of Paul. But it needs both. For perfectly prepared ground, we need both.